Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 56. My name is Karen.
I'm Kristen.
I think I did that. I can never remember how I'm supposed to do it, so I feel like I keep doing it backwards, and it feels awkward when it comes out, but...
It's okay, and if it sounded like I was surprised, it's because I was like, oh yeah, I'm supposed to say my name!
Well, sometimes I say your name, sometimes I throw it to you. I like to keep you on your toes.
It's only 56 episodes. Yeah. We still have no idea what we're doing.
If anybody is here from our Hypeable era, in which we did other podcasts, you know that we never get our lives together. We never know what's going on, so...
It's always chaos, yeah. One form or another.
That's fine. Hey, do we sound better today? Do you guys think we sound better?
I'll bet we sound remarkably better. You know, because the mic we want to use is the one that's actually recording us today. As opposed to a random mic in the room that said, me, my turn.
Yeah, so I bought this really cheap webcam literally so that I could do my therapy with my therapist on my big computer and not my laptop. And it was like a cheap $20 webcam that's the only thing that I use it for. And I didn't realize that Audacity, which we use to record, took that mic last week instead of this mic. And we were like, wow, we look, like you could see on the thing when we're recording. I was like, it looks like it's so quiet. Why is it so quiet? And we're like, it's fine. You know, we use programs to like level everything out and make it sound good. It'll be fine. And as I was editing it, I was like, this doesn't sound great, but you know, there's nothing I can do about it now. Well, today I poked around a little bit and I figured out what was going on. And I was like, wait till I tell Kristen.
Your webcam was like, it's my turn. Yeah. And it was like, no, it's not.
Yeah.
So we're back to our normally regularly scheduled setup.
Yeah. But we're working out the kinks.
But I'm sure we will sound a million times better than last week. So sorry about that. It was a total accident. We had no idea what was going on.
Just looking at the recording now, I'm like, oh, that looks so much better. It looks so much more normal.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like we're settling into our schedule. We have some ideas for upcoming content and everything. But of course, if you guys have ideas, please let us know. You can contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. And apparently, everyone's leaving Twitter to go to Tumblr now. That's not actually true, but a lot of people are talking about it.
I mean...
And I followed Rosie on Tumblr, and she followed us back.
Oh, good.
So, you know, not that that means, not that that means anything to anybody else, but I'm hoping it will inspire me to post more on Tumblr, because I actually really like Tumblr's format, especially to find artwork and stuff, but it's just, like, I can barely keep up with Twitter. Sometimes I get tired, and I can't even do Twitter, let alone everything else.
Right. I would like to formally apologize to anyone who uses our Instagram to stay up to date, because I am in charge of posting, and I fell apart on my job, like, so badly the last month.
Yeah.
But it's all good.
We have valid excuses, so nobody can actually be mad at us.
Yeah, hi, but it's all Callie. Caught up now. Oh, Callie came to visit. Thanks for visiting. She's our friend. But yeah, so thank you guys for hanging in there. It's all caught up now, and hopefully we'll stay that way. So.
And the graphics are really good. Kristen always does a really good job with them. So.
Aw, shucks. Thanks.
Okay, so let's jump into our news and updates for this week. Got a couple of actually, like... outside the box, interesting things to talk about. First up, Reed Riordan posted another article. This one's called How to Win a Wilderness Survival Competition with the Hunters of Artemis. And I thought the timing for this was perfect considering what happens in the chapter this week.
Right? It's kind of perfection.
It was really perfect timing. And also, Becky posted a picture from Vancouver of like, the trees and the mountains and the fog, and I wrote a little thing about like just being able to see the hunters like walk out of that fog, weapons at the ready, wolves at their feet, and it was very inspiring. So everything just feels like it's falling into place this week.
Mm-hmm.
Given what we were just talking about with Twitter, because if you haven't heard, just go look at what's happening with Twitter. Taylor K. Mejia reminded everyone that she is much more active on Instagram, so make sure you're following her there for TV, books, and life updates. It's at Taylor K, T-E-H-L-O-R-K-A-Y. And, yeah, especially the TV updates part, I'm really looking forward to. I mean, and her books as well. But because we know Paola is getting adapted, I'm, you know, hoping that we can stay on top of that news there. That'll be pretty cool. I pretty much exclusively get my news from Twitter because Rick is pretty active on there. And, like, he retweets all the important information. But maybe I'll have to start checking Instagram more, too. Because a lot of people use Instagram a little bit more than Twitter, because Twitter's been a hellscape for a very long time.
Yeah, it's a shame because I love Twitter so much. Like, it's been so easy for me to use, and I've never really mastered Instagram all that well. So I've loved that Twitter has been a main source of news and information for people for so long, and it kind of breaks my heart that now it's becoming an absolute dumpster fire. But we're living with it, and maybe this will make me actually figure out how to use Instagram. I know it's not hard, but for some reason my brain rejects it. It's like, no, I don't know how to do this. I will not do it. And I'm like, it's rude. I did used to use Tumblr a little bit back in the day. I never, like, mastered it like so many people did, but it's not, it's pretty self, you know, like, it's not as hard for me to kind of get into Tumblr, so.
Yeah.
If we have to use something else, I will probably dive into one of them.
I don't think we're going anywhere on Twitter for a while. Yeah. Becky said she's sticking around. I'm sure Rick's sticking around, so unless it totally implodes, we'll be there.
Yeah.
Speaking of updates, A Crown of Wishes by Roshni Chokshi is getting an adaptation, which is coming to Disney+. This is very, very exciting for a lot of different reasons. It will be a live-action adaptation based on the second book in the Star-Touched Queen duology. Apparently, I haven't read these, but apparently the two books are, like, loosely related, but they're two separate stories. It's like the couple, I think, in the first book shows up in the second book, but they're kind of two different entities. We also know that Avantika will star and executive produce, which is pretty interesting because I'm pretty sure she's 17 years old, so, you know, good for her. But she has starred in a few different things, including Spin and Senior Year. And I found this really interesting because Aryan, aka Grover, was in Spin with her, and she also had a recurring role in Diary of a Future President with Charles Bushnell, aka Luke. So it's all sort of in the family. Kristen and I really love connecting those dots between actors and directors and producers and all that kind of stuff, so this was just really interesting to me. And, of course, this is really cool because the series is a YA series, but it's also rooted in Hindu mythology, which will be awesome to have on Disney Plus, just in general, like having different culture, different mythology, a different kind of story on Disney Plus. But it could definitely pave the way for an Arusha adaptation. If this does well, I would not be surprised if Arusha finds a home very soon.
Yeah, agreed.
Next up, Kwame Mbalia, author of the Tristan Strong series, also has some news for us. But first, he gives everyone a pep talk for NaNoWriMo, and I just think that's really cool. Good luck to anybody who's doing NaNoWriMo. It's very difficult, but you can do it. Stick with it. We're rooting for you.
And absolutely.
Kwame gives some good, fun advice, and he always does, like, sprints on Twitter and stuff and talks a lot about, like, encouraging people to write, so go follow him if you aren't already, if you want to be a writer and you need somebody to cheer you along. But the big news here is that Kwame is also going to be heading up a new imprint for Disney, which is so exciting. It's called Freedom Fire, and it aims to publish middle grade books that feature stories of Black resilience and Black joy written by Black creators. It will debut in spring 2024, and it will include chapter books, novels, and graphic novels, and it will span science fiction, fantasy, contemporary stories. Basically, this is just about journeys in whatever form they come, and he specifically talks about it celebrating diasporic culture, which I find very interesting, and I feel like it's great that this is coming from Disney. It's great that this is not connected to Rick Riordan Presents, but because Kwame has published under Rick Riordan Presents, I think it's a good, like, path, like one can lead to the other or back and forth.
They're linked, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And, of course, we need more stories like these, so that's really cool. Mm-hmm. And he wrote that anthology, Black Boy Joy, as well. And I think he talks about this a little bit. Yes, he does. I'm ahead of myself here. Mbalia said that after his success with Tristan Strong and in editing the anthology Black Boy Joy, 17 stories celebrating black boyhood, he felt called to go beyond writing and help to nurture talent in other authors, particularly those of the African diaspora. I'd picture myself opening an independent press decades down the line, he said. Imagine my delight when I struck a deal for an imprint at Disney Hyperion. It was amazing, but it also made total sense. Freedom Fire is necessary. Love that. Mm. Very excited that it's coming from Disney. I really like that Disney keeps picking up these kind of imprints. It's very, very important. We know that there's a fantasy and short story anthology underway, plus more stories that are still kind of under wraps. We don't know much about them yet. But considering who Kwame knows and just all of the other fantastic black authors out there, I think that this print is going to have a lot of heavy hitters. But I also think it's going to have some newer authors as well who will be able to come up through this, kind of like some have done with Rick Riordan Presents.
I was going to say, I'm sure there will be authors and new voices that will find their home at Freedom Fire and will probably write multiple books and or series for Freedom Fire, whereas there will probably also be authors that are somewhat well established that come in and write a series for Freedom Fire and then go back to writing all, you know, what they do, where they do, how they do.
Right.
So it'll be nice to see, yeah, a little bit of both. See some heavy hitters come in and say, I want to write for this. Like, of course I do. And then also see some new voices pop up and get to experience that too. So
yeah,
it's good fun.
For sure. And we will obviously keep an eye on that as well. And maybe some of the RRP authors, ones we're already familiar with, or future ones, will also be writing under this imprint.
Definitely a possibility.
We can share those as well. All in the family.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It is time for our main discussion today. And you might remember that last week we left it as a mystery because we didn't know what we were going to talk about.
We weren't sure. Yeah. Undecided.
But that's totally fine. And we have a better grasp on our schedule now. We came up with some ideas, so I'm a little less worried about making sure we know what we're talking about week to week. But this week, we decided to talk about the Lotus Hotel and Casino and what sort of references and Easter eggs we would like to see in that scene slash episode of the Percy Jackson and the Olympians TV show, because we know that they were just filming those mm-hmm. scenes. And of course, I think the Lotus Hotel specifically opens the door to just a lot of stuff that you can do in the background and like fun little references and stuff, because obviously it's kind of a time hole and
right.
you can kind of peel back the curtain a little bit.
Yeah.
So obviously the biggest one here that I kind of just already tossed out because I know that we were already going to talk about this was Nico and Bianca. Those are the obvious ones that people really want to see references to. 99.9% sure we will not see their faces because they're not going to cast Nico that early. But maybe, you know, the back of his head or, like, part of his bomber jacket or his sneakers.
Or drops him with a magic card.
Right, exactly.
Something.
Yeah, or you just hear somebody in the background yell, like, hey, Bianca, hold on, or something like that, you know?
Or Bianca yelling, Nico, stop that! Like, you can't run off like that, or something.
Yeah, exactly. I think that could be really cool. So there are a lot of different ways to do that, but I kind of wanted to think outside the box a little bit in terms of what we could see, because there's a few different directions you can take this in. We know that even though it's a casino, like they have a lot of video games and stuff like that for kids, and so you can kind of go that route. Of course, Percy Jackson now being a Disney property, you can definitely do all sorts of Disney references. So the first thing that came to my mind was, how can I get Hercules into...
Surprise, surprise!
Into the Lotus Hotel and Casino. And I googled Hercules video games because I watched my cousin play a lot of video games when I was younger, but I never really played them myself. And so I actually didn't know that there was a Hercules video game that came out in 1997, the same year as the movie. So
nice.
I thought that was pretty interesting and it's a good throwback. I think it's called, like, Hercules the Action Game or something, like, kind of lame like that.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. It was originally available on PlayStation and Windows, and it is now available currently on Steam, so you can download it on Steam and play on your computer. I'm considering it because I would love it. Actually, I liked the gameplay. It looked pretty cool. But apparently it doesn't look that great on modern monitors because obviously it's from 1997. How much have they actually, like, remastered it or anything like that? Probably didn't.
Yeah, probably not a whole lot of work done.
Yeah, I heard the audio is also not great, so we'll see. I think it's pretty cheap. It's like $5, so I might just download it and play it anyway. But I imagine this being like, maybe they turn it into an arcade game, or maybe there's some kids on a computer that, you know, they just see this in the background. Obviously, Hercules could very much well be, like, established in this universe as a Disney movie in a property, and they can make references to, oh, Hercules is nothing like that, or, like, the movie wasn't anything like how it is in real life, or even making jokes about how great of a father Zeus is in that movie versus real life. There's a lot that they could do with that. And I also want to shout out Ian, who also brought this game up in our mentions on Twitter. I was like, yes, Hercules was, like, at the top of my list. I had to include this on here.
Yeah, for sure. It makes sense. I feel like they have to mention it's Disney. It's a Disney show. It's owned by Disney. Hercules is owned by Disney. I feel like they have to work a mention in there somehow. And this is one of the more obvious, easy ways to kind of, like, combine the two. So yes, I think there's absolutely every chance that we could maybe see some sort of Hercules game or something like that worked into the Lotus Hotel.
Okay, so by the way, we came up with our list separately, which is a little bit easier to do now that we don't live together because we're not, like, always talking
stealing
about
each
it.
Other's ideas. Yeah,
yeah. So that was kind of cool. But you had some Disney Easter eggs on here, too, that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, like, basically, it's a Disney show, and as I said, it's a Disney show on Disney Network. Like, they can use any of the Disney movies as, like, game fodder. I mean, basically, every Disney movie has its own PlayStation game or whatever these days anyway. So it would make sense to kind of, because he's Percy Jackson, to kind of stick to some of the water games. So, like, maybe a Finding Nemo arcade game or a Little Mermaid arcade game, especially with the Triton references and all of that, because it does kind of lean into Greek mythology a little bit. So, yeah, I feel like that's kind of the obvious one. I also just recently, we learned that Disney is going to be debuting the new Doctor Who episodes.
Right.
And so I'm kind of like, the Lotus Hotel is a time suck. This is exactly the kind of thing the Doctor would investigate.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know if they had the deals worked out in time. I'm putting that out there. Like, I don't feel like they had everything worked out. But I just think it would be hilarious to, like, see a TARDIS reference or, like, a TARDIS in the corner or something, because this is exactly the kind of thing the Doctor would be like, why is there this giant time anomaly in the middle of Las Vegas in 2014 or whatever year this took place in?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like the Doctor would totally be there, so I feel like that's definitely something that could be at the Lotus Hotel.
I really love that, because you're right, he totally would investigate something like that, and you wouldn't even need, like, rights to some of the things if they had just a plain police box in the background, or if they mentioned about some guy with, like, a really long scarf, or, you know, something that obviously alludes to the Doctor without name-dropping it. I feel like they could still do that. And I want to say that Rick is a Doctor Who fan. I feel like I've heard him talk about that before, so
I mean,
he might be excited to drop something in there.
Maybe even just, again, audibly, like we kind of said with Nico and Bianca, like, maybe just audibly throw a sound in there, or, like, pretend there's a Doctor Who game and, like, use the TARDIS sound.
Yeah.
Noise. I can't do it. I obviously can't do it. But, like, they could totally do something like that. Yeah. I think it would be a lot of fun.
That's awesome.
And then my last one was Wreck-It Ralph, because Wreck-It Ralph is a world of video games in video games. Like, I feel like there's got to be at least one Wreck-It Ralph reference in the Lotus Hotel. Yeah. So,
or even just the Wreck-It Ralph game.
Right, that's what I mean. Yeah. Like, Fix-It Felix or something has to be in that lobby somewhere.
Yeah.
Again, maybe they'll leave it out. I don't know. But it seems the obvious ploy. Because they have to have games in this lobby. And why not lean into the Disney angle rather than trying to get the rights for a bunch of, like, normal, you know, like, specific games that Disney doesn't own and stuff like that.
So. Right, yeah. I totally love that. I also had some ideas about getting the water theme into the show somehow, like into the Lotus Hotel somehow. And I thought, okay, they actually end up staying there for a little while, which means that they have rooms that they would go back to. And their rooms could be something from Disney World. I feel like that would be kind of easy to just sort of set up. So obviously my first thought was a Hercules-themed room because all of that Greek motifs and, you know, all of the references there would fit perfectly. But then I was like, or it could be like underworld-themed, which could be kind of cool. Or maybe Percy gets the Ariel room because he's a son of Poseidon, which I think would be so funny.
Right. I've personally stayed in a Pirates of the Caribbean themed room at Disney World. So, like, I know they have ship themed rooms that are kind of built in there. I've stayed at, I think, Caribbean Beach, I believe is where I stayed. So, like, it's slightly off grounds, but it's on grounds, but it's slightly off from the parks and stuff. But, like, yeah, I definitely think they could kind of steal some inspiration from some of those Disney hotels and make some of the Lotus Hotel rooms themed like that. I think that'd be
Funny. So, where would Grover say? My first thought was Pocahontas, but, like, do we want a Pocahontas reference in there? What about, like, the Princess and the Frog? I feel like that's a lot of, like, swamp kind of stuff, nature-y kind of stuff.
True. Or, like, Bambi.
Bambi. Aw, he would love a Bambi room. Like a
really
room.
Pretty Bambi.
Yeah. But he would probably be re-traumatized by...
Probably. I'm sure he was traumatized the first time he watched Bambi.
Yeah. And then what about Annabeth? What kind of theme could Annabeth go for?
I mean, maybe she'd be like a Mulan fan.
I mean, she definitely would be.
Like, I could see her staying in a room that was either designed to look like, you know, Mulan's house, like her homestead, or it could be like the Imperial Palace kind of thing, too, with Mulan, in, like, fighting gear on the wall or something.
I like the Imperial Palace part just because of the architecture. I think she would really enjoy
that. Oh, yeah, probably.
Because I was trying to think of, like, some building-centered thing, like, some architecture-centered thing, but I couldn't really come up with anything off the top of my head.
Yeah, my brain's failing me, too. I keep thinking of Disney movies set in New York City. And I'm like, she's seen New York. She doesn't want to stay in a New York-themed room.
Aw, Oliver and Company.
Aw, yeah, that was one that kind of popped in my head. I was like, no, she wouldn't want to stay there. But yeah, you're right. Like, she would probably enjoy either, like, the Great Wall or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, the architecture.
Or maybe, like, 101 Dalmatians, if it's, like, set in London, if it has a London
theme.
Right,
that could be cool.
I feel like she'd be into that.
Yeah.
Okay, so I see on here that you also have some movie reference ideas, and I couldn't let this pass either. So what were yours?
Well, mine, I mean, I basically came up with three ideas. First is an appearance by a movie cast member, maybe as an adult working at the Lotus Hotel.
Yeah.
I feel like it's the obvious one. Like, you could have an Alexander Daddario, or you could have, you know, I know we all want Logan Lerman as, like, a Poseidon-esque. I know some people want to see that. But, like, even if he just kind of showed up as, like, a guy working at the Lotus Hotel, it would be funny.
Just a little cameo.
Right.
I would be into that.
Just because we know that they're supportive of the show. They've been pretty outspoken about their support of the show and how much they're excited for it. So, like, I just think it would be really funny to see one of them or two of them pop up in the Lotus Hotel.
Yeah. How funny would it be? This just popped into my head. If there was some sort of, this is a little involved, but like some sort of convention or some sort of reason why they would be dressing up as like mythological characters, and then you got somebody like Anthony Stewart Head dressing up as Chiron in the hotel, but he's not actually Chiron, but it would still be a reference to the movie. I would find that kind of funny. That might be a little too layered.
I mean, the Lotus Hotel could totally host a convention.
Yeah.
So it might not be that far off. You never know. But that would be funny.
And then you could get Stanley Tucci dressing up as Dionysus get him in the show.
Any excuse right? for Stanley Tucci on my screen.
Yeah.
I love him so much. So I would be totally down for that. But yeah, I also thought that if they wanted to, they could do, like, the Grey Sisters' eyeball rolling around at the Lotus Hotel. Because, like, they were pretty iconic. Like, in that movie, they were so good and so entertaining. And I thought maybe you could pull, like, a Yvette Nicole Brown in or something.
Right.
Because she's so much fun. She loves, you know, fandom and all of that stuff. So, like, she would probably love to make a quick cameo. But I don't know if you could get any of the actresses back for that. So, like, even if it was just the eyeball, like, getting tossed around or rolled by as they were doing something, it would be a fun way to kind of tie a movie reference in.
Or, like, Crazy Taxi, but it was, like, somehow related to them.
Yep.
That would be good.
Like, a Grey's Sister taxi game.
Yes!
Oh, that would totally work.
What? Disney, hire us. We're geniuses. Right?
We're so good at this. Yeah, and then the last thing that just kind of popped in my head at the end was, we know that Medusa owns a statuary emporium in the first movie, and so it would be kind of funny if, like, there was, like, a statue or two in the Lotus.
That's actually really smart. I really like that, because they would have already met Medusa by that point, so they could just look at this, even if it wasn't, like, a movie reference, like, just look at the statue and go, I know where they imported that from. Like, that would just be a funny thing to say.
Right, or, like, Grover looks at it and goes, do I know that? Like, do I know that satyr?
Yeah.
Like, because they've already released and freed a couple of them having visited Medusa at that point. But, yeah, it would be interesting.
And the Lotus Hotel would definitely order stuff from Medusa. Right. So that would make a lot
for
of sense.
For decor and other reasons, yes.
Definitely. I had a few ideas for movie references as well. The one that I mostly landed on was some reference to Grover, because I actually rewatched the movie scene, and it's so ridiculous, but whatever. So in that, Grover gets his hooves painted red, and also he does this whole, like, breakdown dance, like, sequence, and I can just imagine Arian's Grover, like, they wanted to, or they were trying to paint my hooves, and, you know, they were trying to get me to dance, and I said no, or something, just where it's like, you know that this is a reference to the movie, but they're, like, clearly saying, that's ridiculous, we're not doing that, we're going in a different direction.
Right, yeah. kind of poking a little bit of fun, but good-hearted fun. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I see that we were definitely on the same page with some things, because some of this just, I feel like, is not obvious, but it's so perfect that you have to be able to throw in.
Slash, I may have stolen the idea from you. I saw that you had a famous person.
I was giving you credit.
No. I saw that you had a famous missing person, and I was like, oh my god, that's such a good idea. So then I kind of, like, racked my brain for some other options.
So what did you come up
with? I'll give you credit first.
Thank you.
No, I mean, if you think about it, there's a couple of missing or kind of legendary figures that we don't know what happened to them.
Right.
I'll leave yours, because yours is kind of the biggest one, I think. But I also came up with Jimmy Hoffa. There's this running gag that Jimmy Hoffa is buried somewhere and nobody knows where his body is, but maybe he's not dead. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's been in the Lotus Hotel and Casino this whole time, so he could be, like, dressed in 20s, 30s gangster wear and, like, in a pinstripe suit and just look really out of place, but he's been there this whole time because he loves to gamble and he loves to...
I was gonna say, him strolling into a casino would make a lot of sense.
Right. So, like, I figured that could definitely work and fit right in.
Mm-hmm.
The other one that jumped out at me was D.B. Cooper, which might be a little more niche, especially for, like, middle grade kids. I didn't know who D.B. Cooper was until a couple of years ago.
What was it that we watched that, like...
There's a couple of references to D.B. Cooper in some stuff that came out recently.
Yeah.
There was also a documentary that came out not too long ago about the mystery of D.B. Cooper. I forget what show initially we saw the reference in, but I know Catch Me If You Can, the Leonardo DiCaprio movie, kind of hints at a D.B. Cooper reference.
I'm thinking specifically of somebody was like, you were D.B. Cooper? And it was like, he, like, played it off or something like that. Oh, it was in Loki.
That's what it was!
Yes, yeah.
So, yeah. But I feel like it would be really funny if it was almost like D.B. just feels like he just got there still. Like, he's been there for 20 years, 30 years, maybe 50 years at this point. I'm bad at math. but, like, if he's still got the parachute on his back, because D.B. Cooper is basically famous for jumping out of a plane and no one ever knowing where he went from there.
Right.
And he stole a bunch of money.
Yeah.
So, like, it would make sense if he ended up in a casino.
Or a hotel.
Right.
Trying to lay low in a hotel.
In Las Vegas, where there's a million people every day coming and going, like, mm-hmm. he could hide there very well. So I feel like it would totally work out if he was just kind of milling among all of these children and doesn't realize that all of this time has passed.
Yeah. I actually like your ideas better than mine because I feel like they make a little bit more sense. I chose Amelia Earhart because she was kind of like the most famous person who's just like disappeared. I feel like everybody's heard of her. And she is also very recognizable. So if you see a woman in like goggles and the hat and the bomber jacket, like you know who that's supposed to be. But later in the books, we learn that Aeolus, who we were just talking about, I think he's the one that's protecting Mount Olympus right now
right.
from Kronos getting in, supposedly was the one to knock her out of the sky, and the gods are like still mad at him about that. So I don't think that she's, you know, canonically hiding in the Lotus Hotel, but the show can be different from
right.
the books, so it's still a possibility, and
right.
I think it would be pretty funny to for them to just be like, wait a second, is that an Amelia Earhart cosplayer, or, oh no, it's the real deal.
Right? Like, yeah, she is really iconic, and I do, while it may not, like, pan out quite as easily that she would make it to Lotus Hotel, I think if she was walking around with her goggles on her head and, like, her whole flight suit kind of leather jacket look thing, it would be really easy to kind of sneak her in there, and, like, maybe another demigod in the place says, oh, no, that's Amelia Earhart. She's a demigod, duh. Like you know, like some reference to the fact that she was a demigod because she was in the Percy Jackson world. So, yeah, I feel like that could be a lot of fun.
Okay, so then obviously there's gotta be, I feel like Percy Jackson specifically is really good at being self-referential. It's, you know, a parody of Greek mythology. It's very self-aware. And I like when, I think the show also could break that fourth wall a little bit in a really clever way. And it sounds like one of the things you have on here, maybe not quite the breaking of the fourth wall, but I really like your idea.
Yeah, I mean, again, I kind of stole the idea from you. But, like, I read, you know, your suggestion. I was like, you know what? This makes a lot of sense. Like, they could definitely do a game that is loosely based on Greek mythology that hints at something coming up, that mm-hmm. foreshadows an event that's going to come up. And Percy would never pay any attention to it. He wouldn't remember it.
Right.
But we could notice it
yeah.
and remember it. And it would be fun for us to be like, oh my gosh, that definitely foreshadowing there. So my idea was a game where, like, you're on a ship or something and you have to dodge, like, water hazards, or actually dodging Scylla and Charybdis, because we know that in the next season they're going to be on a ship
yeah.
trying to navigate the waters between Scylla and Charybdis and figuring out how to get past them. So, like, I feel like there could be a video game kind of themed to, you know, water terrors of
yeah.
blah, blah, blah. Like, Greek water. I don't care. You know.
Yeah.
They could do it a million ways, but
Terror of the Mediterranean.
Right? Like, that could just be a lot of fun and a great way to foreshadow what they're going to be tackling next season
yeah.
in a quick moment.
I keep imagining, like, Grover playing a game and he gets to the level where he has to fight a Cyclops and he keeps dying. Like, he can't get past it. Like, for us, that would be so heavy, like, so big, we would know what that would mean. For them, it wouldn't be anything, but to hint, I really love the idea of hinting at Sea of Monsters. I think, again, in a scene like this, you could do that very easily, not have to take a lot of time to do it. Could be a shot that they pan over a game called Sea of Monsters or something like
right,
that.
Right, and
like,
some kids playing it, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be super involved, but yeah, that's why I'm so excited for this scene, and I think it'll probably end up being at least a good part of the episode, I feel like, because there's so much that you could do with something like this. So I'm really hoping that We get that.
I think that's one of the things, I mean, we've talked about all the things the movies did wrong, but I think that's one of the things the movie does itself a disservice with, is they kind of rush through the Lotus Hotel. Like, it has 5 minutes of screen time, and you get a lot in that 5 minutes, but I think with the show, they can spend half to a full episode of them losing time in this place, and, like, you can actually feel a bit of them, like, oh, we spent more time here than I thought. Like, we need to get out of here. And then getting out and finding out that days have passed. Uh-huh. Like, I think you'll get that feeling better in the show than we ever did in the movie.
Yeah. And we've talked before, and you're not a huge fan of bottle episodes, right?
They can be good. Yeah. But I've seen so many that are really rough or are really, like, heavy on flashbacks and stuff that they kind of bore me more than
that. Yeah, that's fair. I think the Lotus Hotel could be a good bottle episode because it helps keep that claustrophobic feel of the Lotus Hotel where you're trapped. If you don't see anything in the outside world for, like, this entire episode, it'll feel very heavy.
Agreed.
And overbearing. So,
yeah, no, I definitely agree.
So, yeah, so I really wanted some sort of self-referential video game reference slash Easter egg here, basically where, like, Percy can play it, and he's like, this feels very familiar to my life, or something like that. Like, one where you're supposedly a demigod, and you have to battle a minotaur, or something like that. Or, if that's too on the nose, maybe a video game that recreates famous myths, like the Trojan War, or, like, anything like that. And I think that kind of goes with what you were talking about with the Sea of Monsters references. It could specifically be, like, Odysseus, and it was Odysseus, right? And Polyphemus.
Yes.
No one. You know, things like that, I feel like, could fit in really well with this world.
Agreed. Yeah. No, it'd be a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I think, just to kind of, like, wrap it up, I do think if Disney wanted to, they could do just classic video game Easter eggs. It wouldn't mean as much. I mean, it's the Disney references and the Percy references and the Greek references would be so much more meaningful to us as viewers and fans of the book series. But they definitely could throw in, like, a Mario video game, a Sonic, a Kirby. Like, that would still be fun, especially for, you know, video game fans and stuff like that. I don't see them doing that. I think it's a little kind of off the path. But if they got the rights to use them, just their likeness for a moment, you might see stuff like that in there as well.
Or, like, the really classic games could help date the certain characters, like Pac-Man or Miss Pac-Man, you know, something that was, like, very much of a certain era, to be able to see, like, the older, like, the original Mario or the original this or that, I feel like could be really cool. Shout out to the X-Men and Ninja Turtles games of the 90s, because loved those.
A little Mortal Kombat.
Yes.
Or Street Fighter.
How did I not think of Mortal Kombat? That would have been perfect.
Yeah, no, you definitely could. Honestly, I could also, I'm throwing this out there right now, I could also see, like, Kingdom Hearts references.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Because it's another Disney game property that they could definitely
Throw, like, a Dreamlight Valley reference in here. Like, what if somebody was playing it in the background or something? But I don't want this to turn into Ready Player One, which I wasn't a huge fan of, but I know some people really like that movie. That had a million references, and it works in that world, even though it was a lot. I don't think that they could really go that far with this, but just to see what they come up with and how they can make this a really interesting moment for the show, I think is going to be fascinating to watch.
Yeah, Ready Player One as a book is a giant reference.
Yeah.
Like, everything is a reference to a movie, to a book, to a video game, to something. So, yeah, that movie was chock full. And I feel like they can have fun here, but I don't think they'll overdo it. It'll be well done.
Exactly.
All right.
I think
that was fun.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. And if you guys have any more ideas, let us know. If you really like some of our ideas, let us know. We love being told that we're smart and amazing. So.
I mean,
who doesn't?
Right?
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
If you disagree, you can tell us that too. But
absolutely.
That's not as fun.
We like all sorts of input.
Yeah.
All right, so now we should probably talk about chapter 10 of The Last Olympian, entitled, I Buy Some New Friends. Mrs. O'Leary is chowing down on a turned over hot dog truck. Argus is clearly freaked out based on the look on his face, but everyone else is knocked out, courtesy of Morpheus. Argus is now headed back to camp to guard it as best he can, but before he goes, he unloads a video shield Annabeth had Beckendorf make before his untimely passing. With it, they can see anywhere sunlight touches, which gives them an eye in the sky to look for incoming danger. Connor Stoll sees an unguarded candy store and probably would have looted it if it weren't for the scolding he got for even considering it. Percy sends Mrs. O'Leary off on a quest to find Grover and then focuses back on the matter at hand. Selina explains why only the mortals were affected by the sleeping magic, which surprises Percy a bit. Annabeth then shows him that a fleet of speedboats is approaching Manhattan off the Long Island Sound. They're carrying a purple banner that Percy quickly identifies as Kronos' battle flag. Annabeth does a quick scan of the island's perimeter and discovers a ferry swarming with Draconi and Hellhounds, with a pack of Telekines swimming in front. She then looks out from Manhattan and notices that time slows the closer you get to Manhattan. Clearly, Kronos is messing with time, in addition to Morpheus' sleeping curse. With more than 300 enemies making their way to Manhattan, Percy looks to his 40 fighters and makes the bold declaration that they will defend their territory. Since the air is already well defended, they only need to worry about a ground or water assault. It's then that Percy remembers Athena's advice to remember the rivers. He tells his forces to concentrate on the bridges and tunnels, and he'll handle the water. Percy directs all of them to stop up the most likely entrances to the island, utilizing their skills to the greatest effect. Annabeth reminds Malcolm to activate Plan 23 en route to their assignment so she and Percy can stick together. This announcement elicits some giggles as the troops separate to hold their assignments, but we just keep right on moving. Just then, Jake Mason reminds Percy that he forgot to staff the Lincoln Tunnel, which definitely has some enemies heading through. Just then, a girl's voice chimes in, offering to handle it. The Hunters of Artemis have arrived on the scene, almost doubling their force size. Talia leads the pack, thrilling Annabeth to no end. Percy and Annabeth know they need to get moving, so they borrow a red Vespa and make their way to the waterfront. Their progress is slow as they stop to help mortals in peril that they're unaware of, including putting out a pretzel cart fire and saving a runaway baby carriage that turned out to have a poodle in it. Annabeth makes Percy stop at Madison Square Park to visit a statue, and she tells Percy that nearly all the statues in Manhattan are automatons, as Daedalus thought someday he might need an army. Plan 23 is to activate one statue and the rest will activate each other. Percy tells Annabeth to wait at Battery Park while he dives into the rivers because, you know, she can't exactly breathe underwater. Annabeth warns him to be careful because they need him for the battle, of course. Percy dives in, swims until he can feel the current of both rivers. He ends up insulting them, as best he can, and they're about to fight each other but decide to try and kill Percy first. He blocks everything they throw at him except for one piece of glass, but it shatters against his chest thanks to the River Styx. Percy challenges them both to protect Manhattan with the Sand Dollars payment. Both rivers are eager to earn it, so he snaps it in half and promises a piece to each. The river spirits sink boats and pummel creatures. Percy breaks the surface and tells Annabeth he was successful. She has bad news, though. There's a major monster force crossing the Williamsburg Bridge, led by the Minotaur. There's a lot that goes on in this chapter.
Yeah, it's a lot of bouncing from one thing to another. A lot of setup, but, like, important setup, too.
Agreed. So, we'll just jump right in here. First of all, I had to make note of Mrs. O'Leary being in hot dog heaven because she's so cute and, like, duh, of course, all of these mortals have fallen asleep. There's hot dogs all over the ground. She's going to go chow down, and I just think it's adorable that that's where they find her.
I was actually just really happy that she was awake. Yeah. Like, I was surprised, and I like that we got the explanation that it's much harder to put demigods and monsters to sleep without a concentrated spell because Morpheus was casting a spell over all of Manhattan. It was easy to put the mortals to sleep, but the demigods could kind of resist it. So it had nothing to do with them being up in Mount Olympus and more to do with the fact that they're half god.
Yeah, like if Morpheus used the same amount of magic on one demigod, he could definitely knock them out for a long period of time. Right. But he's using a light amount over a large number of people. It is nice to kind of have the science of the magic explained a little bit. But yeah, definitely cool. Okay, so Argus is also awake because he's, you know, not immortal. Uh-huh. And he's definitely alarmed by the look on his face. Yeah. I kind of love the way Percy kind of describes his visage and how he doesn't say anything because of the eyeball on his tongue.
Yeah.
But, yeah, definitely gets across the whole, like, alarm thing. But I guess the most important thing that Argus gets involved with is this video shield.
Yeah, and, okay, so I was like, really? And then I was like, wait a second. This coming out of nowhere does make sense because it's Daedalus's technology, and Annabeth has been trying to figure it out, so it's not like this is kind of a convenient introduction. I mean, it is, but, like, it makes sense. There has been set up for this in the past with her going through the laptop and everything, but I was like, do we see this anywhere else in the series? I don't remember this shield at all, and I don't know if it gets broken or lost, or if they just never use it again.
Like, this was kind of a surprise to me, too. I could not really remember this shield. Yeah. That she calls it, like, a video shield, so you can look into it and see all kinds of things. You can narrow it down wherever you want. You can direct it wherever you want to see. And I couldn't help but wonder, like, okay, is it more magic than science, or is it more science than magic? Like, it's Daedalus's plan, it's Daedalus's design that she had Beckendorf build. And in thinking all of this, I was like, okay, if it's more technology than magic, wouldn't it attract monsters? Like, I know the monsters are kind of already headed that way anyway, yeah. But, like, I would think they would have been worried about that at camp while it was being built.
Yeah.
And then I started thinking about, like, iris messages and how those can show you things. Like, Percy has looked into iris messages and people have shown him events that were going on elsewhere. So I'm like, why did we make this a video shield invention of Daedalus's and not something that Daedalus was working with, iris magic, water magic, you know? Like, I feel like that's something he would have looked into, and I think it would have explained it better than just being like, oh, it's a Daedalus invention that makes you see everything.
Yeah. I will say that Percy, or I think it was Annabeth, actually, who specifically explains that it takes the light from the sun or the moon, and, like, that's why you can see the video stuff. So to me, that almost sounds a little bit adjacent to the iris technology.
Okay.
And I don't think that throughout the series it's been, like, completely explained the difference between science, technology, and magic and how those things can combine. Because, again, with Daedalus's laptop, like, we kind of just assume that it's maybe more magic than science, and maybe that's why it doesn't attract the monsters. But in this chapter, we also get Percy talking about, like, pick up a phone, call somebody, throw it down, pick up a different phone to make it harder for monsters to attract to you. Makes it harder for the monsters to find you. And so they're still very much aware of this being an issue. So, yeah, like, what makes some of this technology different?
Right, yeah. It's just an interesting item that pops up out of nowhere, and you're just kind of like, okay.
Yeah.
But definitely worth discussion. And I'm interested to see if it gets broken, if it sticks around, if it just disappears and we never talk about it again. Like,
right.
I'd like to see what happens to this shield.
Yeah, for sure. I agree.
Okay, so moving right along, Argus is returning to camp. After he drops off the shield, he gets in the vans and him and the harpies take off. And it just made me wonder really quick, do you think he's gonna try and convince Clarice to enter this fight? Like, he's kind of seen a bit of what, you know, like, they didn't see all of the monsters, but he's been in New York. He's seen these people laying, sleeping on the sidewalk. Is he gonna go back to camp and kind of, like, poke Clarice and be like, you need to get over, I know he doesn't talk, but get over there, you know? Like, I feel like that wouldn't be completely out of character, but it just kind of made me wonder what his role in maybe Clarice coming to battle at some point might be. Like,
yeah.
Because I feel like she has to show up eventually.
Right? Like, I don't think that she can just not be there in the end.
Right. But yeah, okay, so Percy does give Mrs. O'Leary a job, which is go find Grover, and I just was kind of wondering what Grover has been up to in this like, it hasn't been that long since he saw him, but what's he been doing this whole time that he doesn't know what's going on? Like,
yeah.
Percy called Annabeth. She had a cell phone. Like, I'm kind of curious, you know, how Grover is keeping in touch at all, or is he?
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, Percy doesn't know, and he's hoping he's still in Central Park, so.
Yeah, because we saw him wake up from his little sleeping curse, And then, oh, he was going to rush back to Juniper.
That's right. Yeah, he was going back to check to say hi to Juniper and let her know he was alive.
So he was probably back at camp.
So maybe his plan was to return to Central Park ASAP. Yeah. Like, I don't know.
But Annabeth came, but Grover didn't. So that's interesting.
Yeah. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe he reached out to Juniper. Maybe there's a way for him and Juniper to speak without having to leave Central Park that we just didn't get, or I don't know.
Or he went back and talked to her, and then now he's gathering naiads and dryads and stuff like that.
Totally possible. But I thought it was worth noting, because I don't remember how much Grover plays into this battle. Like, my brain cannot remember Grover's role in everything. So, worth mentioning that Percy has thought of Grover, and he wants him ready to help if possible. So. All right. So, basically now, Percy kind of takes over command and starts assigning groups and cabins to different bridges and tunnels and trying to man the entire island and protect all of the entrances to the island, because if they can keep the monster forces from getting into Manhattan, then they can't get to Olympus because the skies are already pretty well defended. Yeah. And I just, it's such a good moment. We talked in the last chapter about how Percy kind of takes on the role of leader, and it's so brief and unceremonial and whatever. And then we get to him here, and he just is the commander.
Yeah, there's no question there. There's no doubt. He just does what needs to be done.
And it made me wonder, like, okay, we kind of know that Percy is the leader here, but, like, why didn't Annabeth stand up and start directing traffic? Mm-hmm. Because she is a child of Athena. This is battle strategy, and knowing who goes where and who's going to do best where is her thing. Yeah.
I'm really torn about this part, because on the one hand, I really like Commander Percy. I really like that he took charge, that he didn't have any self-doubt. He shows his intelligence here. He shows that he's cunning and that he can be a strong leader. This felt a lot more momentous to me than what happened in the last chapter. But on the other hand, I completely agree with you. This is literally what Annabeth is good at. This is like her godly heritage is about what is exactly going on here. And I just, like, I liked that it shows that Percy has learned enough to know how to do this. And the idea, like I said, with the cell phones was clever and everything like that. But it feels like it could have been given to Annabeth. And part of me kind of hopes that maybe in the show, Annabeth will have a moment to shine here. Because, like we said last week, she hasn't been in the book all that much up until this point. And I think that's going to have to change in the show a little bit. And it could be nice even to see them kind of be co-captains of this. You know, one person, they kind of feed off of each other. And they're both on the same page in this moment, rather than Percy kind of taking over what I think would traditionally be Annabeth's role.
Yeah, I think maybe if the show is able to minimize their bickering, because it really is just like small little disagreements that they keep having that kind of keeps them on edge over the last like two books, really. I think if they're able to kind of like on the show maybe eliminate or pare that down a bit and have them really being a force, the two of them being a real leader force here, I do think that would be a really great change to the story and give Annabeth her moment in the sun, because everyone else is being encouraged to use their strengths. Like, Percy's gonna go make peace with the water spirits in a second. We'll get there. Like, he's gonna go do his thing, and you've got him recommending that certain cabins be in the tunnels so they can use their powers to grow vines and stop monsters. And, like, why wouldn't you look at Annabeth and say, you wanna take the lead? Like, this is your battle. Like, you know, like, he's good at being a leader, but a part of being a leader is knowing who's gonna do the best job at this task or whatever.
I feel like this was written in here because Percy is the main character and because we want to see this out of him specifically, but I just love Annabeth. Yeah. And, like, she would be very good at this, so.
Absolutely. I mean, that's basically what it boils down to. We're just really big Annabeth fans and we want her to have her moment. Yeah. But, I mean, she does kind of get some small moments in this chapter, and we'll get to those in a bit. Worth noting, we did already kind of talk about the magic and understanding what Morpheus was up to, but I think it's also worth noting that Cronos is also adding his magic to the equation. While Morpheus put everybody to sleep, Cronos is messing with time and change. The closer you get to Manhattan, the slower you're moving as a mortal. And I think that's fascinating. Like, the rest of the United States has no idea what's going on in Manhattan right now. And the closer you get to solving it and getting to the island to help, the slower you move.
I loved this part because even though it's a lot of exposition and explanation, it didn't feel like it slowed the chapter down at all. It really, like, you could tell he was like, there are no plot holes here, folks. Like, there's a reason why everything's happening. And, like, I really respect Rick as an author for being able to write this in here in a way that, like, didn't bore me or didn't feel like, okay, can we just get to the action now? I found it really fascinating because you learn how the magic is working, why they wouldn't be able to get outside help, and how no one would notice what was happening. And between that and Percy taking over command, this feels like a real war. It feels epic and huge and grown up and mature, and it's like, wow, you know, I wasn't really expecting that. Again, halfway through the book, this is something that you would have leading up to the final climax, but right now things feel huge and we still have a lot more to go.
Well, and like, if you think about the way wars are fought, there's multiple battles going on at the same time and you're looking at a map and you're looking at where troops are and, you know, you're fighting it on three fronts. Well, Percy is basically fighting a war and each little battle is all, it's becoming the Battle of Manhattan eventually.
Yeah.
But these are all individual battles as each of these cabins takes a bridge and says, I'm going to hold this bridge.
Right.
And, you know, it is really warlike and very, the stakes feel heavy and huge all of a sudden, just boom.
Yeah.
I have to give you credit for this next little thing because we see the Hunters of Artemis.
Yes, they show up.
We love. And you had such a good point here about Talia, not the t-shirt. You can have that all your own. Okay. But after that, you had a really good point. So I'm going to let you kind of talk about this because I want to chime in and say, yes, I steal your idea.
That just seems to be the theme of this episode. It's okay. So, yeah, the Hunters of Artemis show up, and I just have to say, I need Talia's Death to Barbie t-shirt because I really love it, and as somebody who's coming into her goth era, I just feel like it would be perfect for me.
Yeah.
But in addition to that, Talia specifically references, or like Percy and Talia are talking, and it's been 1 year since they've seen each other, and Talia kind of jokes with Percy that, like, her adventures were deadlier than his adventures, and he's like, no, they're not, and, like, you could make a whole series out of this year where she hasn't shown up or any of the other Talia moments, like where she's just gone off and Percy, you know, the spotlight's been on Percy, but Talia's been elsewhere. Like, we need a Talia book. I think after Nico, Talia's got to be my number two because you could do anything. And there are so many points in the series where she's come back from something epic. You could write a whole book about that, and I just, like, give me a Talia series.
Right.
That's what I want.
Well, the minute you said this, I was like, yes! Like, we just got Rick announcing this new series for Percy that happens within the Percy timeline, so it's not going to mess with anything.
Right.
But he wants to write this story about Percy getting into college and all of the things he has to do to get into college. And I'm like, okay, seeing that Rick is willing to dive back into his own timeline and write insular stories that aren't going to affect the big story. I want these. I want to know what Talia's been up to for a year. I want to know where she's been and how she has 30 warrior hunters behind her where she had maybe a dozen the last time we saw her. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to know where she found these people. I want to know how she, you know, got them onto the hunter's side. Like, how she, you know, lured them in. But how she, like,
convinced them.
Like, how she convinced them that this is something that they wanted too.
Yeah.
There's so much good material waiting to be written here that I am totally down for either Rick to write this, or if he wanted to co-write it like he did Nico, I feel like there are a lot of great female voices that he could co-write a book
That's
with.
That's what I was thinking.
That would be so, so good for Talia.
Yeah. I specifically, just because she's a little dark and spooky, Taylor K. Mejia, I first came to mind for something like this, but even outside of the Rick Riordan Presents family, finding somebody else to be able to co-write something like this, where it's basically, you would basically have no boys in the book whatsoever, and you could do a lot of really interesting things with that ensemble cast, and with Artemis being kind of at the head of it, yeah, I would really love something like that.
And I mean, because we have textual evidence that Percy and Annabeth haven't seen Talia in a year, you wouldn't have to worry about touching any of those characters at all. Like,
right.
It could just be Talia and these hunters and Artemis and, like, go.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm totally down. I want this series. So I'm just throwing that out there, Rick, in case you're listening.
Add it to the list.
Right? Just add it on there. All right. So the next part of the story is Percy and Annabeth steal a red Vespa, which I wanted a Vespa at one point in my life, so this was magic to me. They steal a Vespa, and Percy makes a note, like, either I'll return it or I'll be dead, and then this guy will be dead, so it won't matter. I love that Rick took the time to tell us that they didn't just buzz off to find the rivers.
Yes!
That they stop along the way and put out a fire at a pretzel cart, and they move mortals out of the way of moving cars and, like, things that could hurt or kill them. They could have just sped by all of this at full speed, as fast as they can, mounting the sidewalk, just get to the rivers.
Because time is of the essence.
It absolutely is. But instead, they take all of these little side adventures to stop all of these little things.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so in character for both of them that it's wonderful, but I'm also like, okay, guys, but, like, don't spend too long saving a poodle. Like, let's keep moving.
To be fair, they did think that was a baby at first.
True, and bless them for saving a baby. You can't not save a baby. But, yeah, it's such an interesting little detail that he adds in, and that's definitely not something Luke's doing or worrying about at all.
And not necessary to the book. Like, I don't think anybody would have thought of that being an issue if he hadn't literally written it in there, but he took the time to lay that out, and I do think that, like you said, it's very in character for them and just goes to show what kind of people they are, and I just... I really love it. I would love to see some montage in the show with them, like, trying to do that.
Like, Annabeth, we can't stop for everyone. Well, I'm not leaving the, you know, like, I could see it being a whole, it would be so cute. So cute. Okay, so the next major plot point is Plan 23. We finally learn what Plan 23 is, in case anybody else forgot, because at first I forgot and then I remembered, But Plan 23 is to awake all of Daedalus's automatons, which basically every statue in Manhattan is an automaton.
Yeah.
And with Plan 23, you wake one or two or a dozen of them on your way in battle, and the rest of them will wake up the rest.
Yeah, and they could have hundreds, if not thousands, of automatons on their side. I really love this. First of all, just the visual alone is really fascinating. I think that could be really cool. But it also throws a little bit of a wrench into this whole plan, into this whole scenario, because they are wildly unpredictable. Percy and Annabeth aren't 100% sure that they don't know that they aren't the bad guys. Because Daedalus planned to use them to either attack or defend Olympus, depending on the circumstances. So are they going to help Kronos' army, or are they going to help Percy's army?
Or are they just going to attack anything that's not an automaton?
Yeah, exactly.
You really don't know. So yeah, it is a little bit of a wild card, but clearly Athena thinks that it's worthwhile because she tells Annabeth to do it.
They really don't have any other choice because they are vastly outnumbered, and again, they're just a bunch of kids.
Right? Like, they're
40 kids defending all of Manhattan.
They're trained kids who know how to use a sword, but still, like, there's more than 300 bad guys descending, and there's now 70 people trying to fight them off. Like, they're outnumbered for sure. Okay, so they stop and awaken a statue and keep moving on toward the river. And they finally get to the river, and Percy just kind of looks at Annabeth and says, "You wait here." And she's like, "I came all this way with you, and now I just have to stand here." But it makes sense because he has to dive into the river so that he can talk to the spirits.
The spirits of the river.
Of the river. Yeah, I was trying to think if there was another, like, technical term for them, but they are basically the spirits of the river.
Because I don't think they're, like, gods necessarily.
No.
Just, like, the embodiment of the river.
Yeah. And so the East River and the Hudson River meet at the harbor near Battery Park, and that's where they are, which is kind of cool. If you're ever, like, in New York, you can go stand at Battery Park and be like,
Yeah.
That's where Percy jumped in. Like, I've been to Battery Park, so I'm like, that's so cool. Like, it's cool to think about. So Percy jumps in, and he insults the spirits.
Yeah. This was so perfect to me, because it's like, how else are you going to get New Yorkers to pay attention to you? You insult them somehow. Otherwise, they're just going to keep on moving. And they didn't have, like, you know, strong New York accents or anything like that, but I felt the New York City person inside of them. Like, it was just so funny. And the first thing they want to do is kill Percy, which makes a lot of... Kill Percy, then kill each other.
Right.
But Percy at least talks him out of that.
After letting them throw things at him and hurting him, but not really hurting him.
Yeah.
I did think it was really interesting that the minute the glass hits Percy and kind of disintegrates, they both kind of stop. And they're like, Child of Poseidon? And he's like, yes. And they're like, took a dip in the River Styx? And he's like, yep. And they know, for, like, in that moment, they're like, why do they always think this is the answer?
Yeah.
And I'm like, who have they come across before that's done this? Like, what Child of Poseidon have they met in the river? What other demigod has dipped themselves in the River Styx to, like, I'm so curious now of how these two rivers that exist in North America have come to understand this and, and know and recognize it on site.
Maybe it's also part of that, like, all water is kind of related, and so, like, they might be able to communicate with the River Styx, or at least, like, messages or information could travel through the river, so, like, they could even hear things that doesn't have to do with them specifically. But you're right, I feel like there's such this legend around the River Styx and, like, dipping yourself into it like Achilles did, and what that means. And I love the idea that, like, it makes you invincible, but everybody knows that, like, this is also a very bad thing. Right. So
yeah.
It kind of raises the stakes a little bit more.
Yeah, it's just one of those things, like, them instantly recognizing it made me stand up a little, like, pay a little more attention, like, uh-oh, like, even they know what's going on here. So, yeah, just very interesting. But Percy breaks the sand dollar that his father gave him last book. Like, I feel like it's, like, a million chapters ago, but it's more like 11 chapters ago.
Yeah, that's true.
He breaks the sand dollar in half, gives half to each of them, and when he breaks it, it cleans the water in front of him. Like, so clearly, they can take the sand dollar to each of their rivers and, like, grind it up, and it'll release clean water into their system, which is really cool. But how did Percy know that this was gonna do this? Like, it's like, instantly, he went, it took him one chapter to go from, Athena told me to remember the rivers, to, remember the rivers, I know exactly what to do. And, like, he just shows up and does it.
Yeah. So, you guys have been listening to this podcast long enough that we are not very critical of Percy Jackson. Like, you know, we're just happy to be here. And, like, I love this series. And that obviously has not changed at all. But, like, I try to give Rick credit as much as possible. And I cannot figure out how to give him credit here. Because Percy got that sand dollar. I completely forgot about it, which I kind of liked because it was like, oh yeah, you know, that was set up at the end of the last book and now we're being able to use it. But you're absolutely right. At the end of the last book, he didn't know how to use it, what it did, when to use it. Poseidon just says, you'll know. And, like, yeah, Percy just knew, but he had no information to tell him how to use it, when to use it. He didn't even know that breaking it in half wouldn't
destroy
the whole thing. Yeah.
That was my thing. I was like, he's gonna break this in half. Like, how does he know that's not gonna just, like, poof the whole thing?
Yeah, exactly. And, like, I could have given him credit if, like, Poseidon had kind of whispered it to him, or if he had felt it grow warm the closer he got to the rivers or something, or, like, he, you know, because I think he, like, put it on his necklace or something in the last book. I was reading the Wikipedia page. I didn't actually go back to the novel.
Gotcha.
But if the rivers had seen it and been like, we want that.
Or what? How about we make a deal? Like, if the rivers had suggested
it. I feel like that would have made a lot more sense. If anybody has an actual answer to how Percy knew this, please give it to me. I would like to give Rick credit, but as of right now, it just seriously came out of nowhere.
Yeah, I'm with you. I really wish he had just worked something in. Like, it could have been something as brief as one of the Stoll brothers asks for a drachma as they're running off to defend their bridge so that they can do an Iris message because they're going to be at the bridge. There's water. It's a whole thing. Like, maybe Percy's tossing drachmas out, sticks his hand in his pocket, and feels the sand dollar. And at that exact moment, Annabeth says something like, you know, something about the rivers or how are we going to defend against all these boats? Mm-hmm. I could see, like, something connecting Percy to the sand dollar and saying, well, it's worth a shot. Like,
or even if Annabeth knew what the sand dollar did, because it's not like they've been communicating a lot. Maybe she didn't see it up until this point. But right. I could totally imagine her knowing what that would do.
Or, like, Percy, do you know what a sand dollar does? Like, do you understand what that could... And then him saying, I know how to handle the water. Yeah. There's so many ways that he could have inserted one small little scene that would have fit into this chapter that would have explained it. But it's just, it's a little too Percy has all the answers.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen often, but this time I do feel like Percy kind of magically comes up with this.
And I can't explain it away. You know, like I can't come up with a good reason why it happened this way. So maybe something will be said down the line, but I kind of feel like it's not going to.
Yeah. But it works in Percy's favor at this moment because he splits the sand dollar and both spirits say, we'll help you. And they sink boats and they... I don't know if they drown creatures, but they, like, flood them with extra water or whatever. Yeah. Like, the telekines that were swimming in the river. Right. Like, they stop them, basically. Yeah. So, it works out, but Percy pops up out of the water to tell Annabeth, and she's like, well, I've got some bad news.
Yeah.
Williamsburg Bridge is being run over, and I think it's the Apollo cabin that needs help. Because I think they were assigned to the Williamsburg Bridge. And she's like, we've got to go. Oh, by the way, the Minotaur is leading the charge. Mm-hmm.
Great callback.
Right?
Great callback to the first book. I love how it's come full circle. And it also shows you that monsters can reform and stuff like that. I really like this. And it means something to Percy. You know, he's already got a little bit of a fear with the Minotaur because he barely defeated it the first time. It was involved with his mother's disappearance. Like, there's a lot of baggage with that, you know?
Yeah, no, he's definitely... If there was a monster that could be leading the charge that Percy hates more than anything, it would be the Minotaur. Like,
yeah,
there's no other monster you could stick there that would make him that much more... energized to go fight. So that seems like that's their next stop is now that they've got the rivers doing their bidding, let's go help out the Apollo cabin or whoever's battling there. All right, so that pretty much wraps up our discussion, but we still have to do favorite quotes and favorite moments. So I will let Karen go first with favorite quotes, because I think yours comes first.
And mine's just a silly little one, because it's when Katie Gardner, you know, surprising, we usually pick Percy, Annabeth, like Grover, you know, one of the main ones, but Katie Gardner says, Connor, this is serious. You are not going to loot a candy store in the middle of a war.
He totally was. Not to mention he also wanted to steal cell phones, because he was like, if I find a really cool one, can I just keep it?
Yeah.
And he's like, no.
It was so funny.
I love them. They're predictable but delightful.
Yeah.
All right, and I chose basically one, but it's kind of two. First of all, I have to throw a little shout out to Percy going, all right, we're going to hold Manhattan, because it's such a bold declaration.
Yeah.
They haven't even started fighting. They're outnumbered 1,000,000 to 1. You don't even have the Hunters of Artemis there yet.
Yeah.
And he's like, we're going to hold Manhattan. And everybody looks at him like, okay, crazy man. I'm like, sure. Like, let's try, but, you know, you're pretty bold here.
Yeah.
All right, whatever. I just love that moment. But I also love Percy's call to action. And he says, you're the greatest heroes of this millennium. It doesn't matter how many monsters come at you. Fight bravely, and we will win. For Olympus!
Yeah. So, I know we usually do all of our discussion during the previous section, but I actually had a big thought about this.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you chose it. I actually want to talk about the line that comes after it, but also the For Olympus part. So he says, For Olympus, and then it goes on to say, they shouted in response, and our 40 voices echoed off the buildings of Midtown. For a moment, it sounded brave, but it died quickly in the silence of 10 million sleeping New Yorkers. Goosebumps down my arm. I mean, that is a good line.
And a visual.
Yeah,
and, like, you can
so
feel
good.
It. Yeah.
And, like, I know that we love TV and everything, but, like, you can show this on TV, but there's something about those words specifically that just weigh so heavy. And I really liked it. You know, we usually pick the funny lines, but this one was really important for me to highlight. I also wanted to talk quickly about, is it weird that they're shouting for Olympus and not for Camp Half-Blood? Because I understand that they have to defend Olympus because it's the right thing to do, but do any of them really feel any loyalty to Olympus or the gods aside from, like, yeah, that's kind of my dad or my mom, I guess, but they're absentee parents, and Olympus has caused a lot of trouble for them. The gods have caused a lot of trouble for these young demigods. And so I was just, not that I think there's anything wrong with them shouting for Olympus, but I'm like, why?
It's a good point. Like, yeah. I don't necessarily think I would have thought about it, because it makes sense for Olympus. We're fighting for Olympus. We're protecting Olympus. It works in my brain. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. Like, you've got an entire Hermes cabin that's made up of unclaimed campers. Like, why are they fighting for a god who doesn't care about them?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Like, they are, because they love their fellow campers. They love, you know, their camp. They love Chiron and even Mr. D. But, like, you know, they want to fight. They're fighting because of that. They're not fighting because Olympus is in New York and they want to protect it. They know that in order to continue to be campers and in order to continue to have each other, they have to fight now. And so you're absolutely right. Like, Percy maybe should have been yelling for Camp Half-Blood, for Chiron, for, you know, like,
yeah.
there could have been a million other things that he would have said that,
or
maybe,
like, for Beckendorf, like,
right?
I mean, that could even have been kind of a cool...
I mean, Selena would have started crying, but everybody else would have been like, yeah, because Beckendorf is everybody's hero.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, that is a really good point. It's a good line, but a good point.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and then we also have our favorite moments. Mine was the Stoll brothers wanting to loot at just about every turn. Keep your eyes on the prize, boys. Like, I know that it's the beautiful levity that Brick brings to his books, and the Stoll brothers are just, they're gold when it comes to that. But I'm just like, come on, guys. Like, I know there's a candy store, but, you know, you can go visit the candy store afterward. No, it won't be free, but we'll figure that out.
Yeah. I actually really appreciated the way that he balanced all this humor with that epic war, like, imagery in your head. I think he did a really good job here.
Agreed. What was your favorite moment?
When the Hunters of Artemis show up, because obviously I couldn't remember if the Ares cabin was going to show up. Like, I kind of thought they were, and then the Hunters showed up, and I got, like, a little teary-eyed, and I was like, oh, it's so good.
It's like, oh, yeah, Talia shows up first, and I love her so much, and yes, thank you. Thank you, Talia. For doubling their numbers.
I mean,
I still can't, like, they don't make a point of it in the book, but they have 40 people fighting, and then Talia shows up with 30 warriors. Like, she almost doubled the size of their force, and it's just, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to 3 other podcasts. If you like revisiting your favorite canceled and cult classic shows, consider tuning into Rewatchable, which has covered series like Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, Angel, and many more. Most recently, we've also discussed all 4 Matrix movies. We also have Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that features our biggest hypes and gripes in fandom and life, and we even post interviews with our favorite creators. Lastly, we also have Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which has previously discussed every episode of the show, conducted many interviews with the cast and crew, and will be covering the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast, or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email your long-form thoughts to us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews really help others to find us, and that is such a big help, and we would love to see them. You can leave us questions or comments in any of these places, or ideas for content you might want to see. We do have 1 bit of feedback this week, and I will throw it to Karen for that.
This comes from Phoebe at Green Schwerp, who said, I feel like the Lotus Hotel and Casino would be a prime place to put a reference to animated Hercules. And you know this was my first thought, but I just had to shout out to Phoebe for being on the same page as me, because I totally agree. It would just be a perfect fit.
It really is. Yeah. Like, there's no better fit. So hopefully we'll see one. I mean, I feel like it's the best place. So
yeah,
we'll just have to cross our fingers and watch season 1. All right, so next week we're thinking we're going to do another deep dive, but not a monster this time. We're going to get back into a god and talk a little bit about Hermes.
Yeah, he was next on our list and also just seemed appropriate for what we had just been talking about, and now that we're into the last book and like the significance of all of that. So I think it'll be an interesting one. I also just, Hermes, I feel like people know Hermes, but they don't know him like they know Zeus or Athena or Ares, you know? There's a little bit more to him than I think some people know, and I'm excited to see if I learn anything new.
Yeah, he played such a big role in the last chapter and kind of seeing the beginning of this Hermes-Luke thing that clearly needs to be resolved before this book is out. Yeah, it's definitely worth diving into and seeing what Hermes has to tell us and what we can learn about Hermes.
Yeah.
All right, until next time, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.